Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Talking About podcast. I'm Sean Kennedy. Back with me on the line is Liberty Ballers' own Dave Early. Dave, how you doing?
I'm good.
Good to hear. Yeah, we're just a couple weeks away from training camp, coming down the home stretch, but we still got some fun news to talk about today. First thing I wanted to talk with you about was Daryl Morey had an interview with John Clark on the Takeoff with John Clark segment, and I thought he had an interesting soundbite that I'm going to read to you here. I transcribed it in full. So,
oh, wow. All
right, not too long, but for anyone that looks on the post on the site for the pod, this episode, I also transcribed it there. So you can also read it, but
if we get another 10 subscriptions, we'll get a producer who will do all this for you.
Yeah. We're a ways away from that. for now, still plugging away on my own, but here it is. I'd say the biggest surprise are the players who can't play here, referring to Philadelphia, of course. It's actually not helpful to me. The more options I have, the better. But I do think I'm starting to learn, and I do love it about Philadelphia because I do think it gets the best out of our team. And I've seen it with not only our team, the Eagles, and the Phillies. And I never understood this being in Houston when people would say, oh, you need to have a special mindset to play in Philly. You need to have a special mindset to play in maybe New York, although I think that's less true. Honestly, I can only speak to Philadelphia because I've been here now. I really do pay attention to the mindset of the players. Can they handle playing in Philadelphia? Because I do think it's a different thing. So the first initial reaction, Dave, from a lot of people was, is this a subtweet to Ben Simmons, who infamously seemed not to handle the pressure of playing in Philadelphia, even when he was with Brooklyn? It came and there was a lot of speculation, oh, is he going to play? And that quickly squashed. Of course, it was later determined that he had a legitimate back injury and required surgery after the season. We know what happened with Ben and Philly. We don't need to dive into that. Do you first, before we get into the broader kind of conversation around the mindset to play in Philadelphia, do you think Daryl was referring to Ben here?
100% referring to Ben. I think he's admitted it surprised him that Ben didn't want to play in Philly. You know, he would have happily continued shopping Ben while stacking a few more wins with a better defense last year. I think probably the Sixers surprised him and everyone by being pretty good, better than expected without Simmons. But I think he thought the trade value and the ultimate standings would have been better if Ben was playing. Ben surprised by not wanting to. I think there's a little bit of revisionist history. I don't think it was strictly the fans is what Ben was out for. I think he really thought this is my best chance to get a trade. It's not just that I'm really worried about the fans. But I think that is what Daryl is implying for sure, that you do have to have a certain mindset. And then I think below that, if you get your machete out to dig through the next layer, he did admit that it's not easy for him. And so you could say there's a subtweet at the fans too. Like, my job here is a lot harder than it was in Houston because our fans boo our players. And I need to make sure that I have the right players who can handle that if it happens.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's, I guess it's kind of like a Venn diagram. Like, you want to be in a big market that free agents or guys that are seeking a trade would want to come to get more exposure, be in, you know, have access to bigger decision makers and under industries for their kind of like side projects and side businesses and whatever. So it's good to be in a big market, but you also don't want the kind of reputation of being a tough place to play, like Philadelphia or New York, like he mentions. So Yeah, I guess like LA is kind of the perfect in that regard because it's, you know, entertainment capital of the world, but in a lot of ways the sports scene is a little more, it's less life or death there for people, I would say, because there's so much else going on.
You
And
spend a day, if you spend a day at the beach and then you go to a ball game, it's like, hey, this is fun.
yeah, right. It's more of a treated like the recreational entertainment it is in reality than the thing that's, you know, determining your mental well-being.
I went to a Jets Chargers game once. It was a playoff game and the Jets won on the road. This was back in like 09 or whatever. The Jets made the AFC Championship game.
Back when the Jets won games on the
Exactly. And it
road.
was a huge game and everyone back home, this was life or death. It was like the Jets have been good for the first time since the 60s, blah, 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 Joe Namath. And then I remember sitting next to in the stadium, this dude who was like, I mean, I don't care. I'm going surfing tomorrow. And I was like, oh, it's different out here.
Yeah. The vibes are definitely different. Yeah, so maybe it's just beach areas like Miami where they famously show up in the second quarter for playoff games even.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe that's just what it is. You just got to go in a big city near where they have a beach nearby.
You know, Covington recently came out and said, like, you know, the fans wrote him here, and he was a polarizing figure, which is crazy because he's been perennially one of the best 3-and-D players in the game, and he shoots a good percentage. But the Sixers fans don't love streak players. And I think that's gotten exacerbated a little bit with Doc, who seems to be a huge believer in the hot hand. You know, there's been some studies on the hot hand. It's like this hot button issue in analytics communities. It's like, if you've missed three threes in a row, there's a good chance Doc's going to bench you, first of all, especially if you're Matisse Thybulle. And, you know, that could impact a guy like De'Anthony Melton next year. PJ Tucker is not a volume shooter, so he could miss two threes in a row. And fans kind of got on Danny Green. So you wonder, does Daryl have to factor things like that in? Like, can DeAnthony handle it if he's missed his first six threes of the game and the crowd starts getting on him? That wouldn't happen in Memphis.
Right. Yeah. So I guess that leads into the second kind of topic around that. So what do you think is the correct mindset to succeed in Philadelphia? What would be your summarization of the right mentality for it for success?
I kind of liked it when the players play back at it. Like, I know Horford and Joel and maybe Tobias have all shushed the fans. And I know the fans didn't all like that, but I think that's something that you don't mind seeing from your players because you don't want them to be completely immune. I saw the quote that Russell Wilson had returning to Seattle. He didn't play especially well. A lot of the fans booed him, and after the game, he was like, look, I'm just happy to be here. You know, God's blessed me. And I was like, I'd rather see a little bit more genuine, just appreciation that it either bothered you or didn't. You know, just let us know. And if you don't feel you have to hide it, that's not a bad thing. Like, you look at a guy like Kyrie Irving, who clearly performs at his best in these brutally hostile environments, right? And he doesn't play down to it. He kind of adopts that WWE villain heel and gives it back to the crowd and plays his best. Reggie Miller used to also, and I think that's kind of the fire you're looking for.
Yeah, I think the fire, or I would kind of categorize it as like showing you care. And people want to see their athletes in the city like care as much as they do. So if you're just kind of like nonchalant and like whatever, it doesn't really bother me. This isn't like the biggest priority in my life, which I think there are a lot of other things, like a lot of them revolving around shooting, obviously. But I think the biggest thing that turned people off to Ben in a lot of ways was just he really didn't have that fire. He just never seemed like
He did all he
be
could to hide it if he
yeah
did, yeah.
being it just always seemed like from afar that being the best at his craft and being a winner was never the most important thing to him. It was more about like being a star, being in the limelight. That just how it seemed to people, whether that's
Yeah.
true or not. That I think that's just how it came across. So there's that, and then I think you also have to be able to kind of just like shrug it off. Like if fans do boo you, you can't take it personally, and you have to be able to say like that just it just comes with the territory. They're gonna boo you when you're underperforming. They're gonna cheer you like you're a hero when you are playing well, and just not having the mindset that like, hey, this is a personal attack, and just kind of realizing that this is just how it is. I think that's a big part of it.
I agree with Daryl that it's not always helpful. I do think it's another challenge for him. I know the PR version of this filters out the killers. This filters out the best guys and brings out the best of the guys who can handle it. But I think the flip side is something we see when the Sixers get tight in the playoffs. Like it might happen in a huge game and no one is playing especially well. Like maybe Tyrese Maxey has a flash and the crowd gets kind of quiet and tight, and maybe a smattering of boos after Danny Green airballs a shot. And I think then you'll see another team, like they'll flip on a game in, you know, Oklahoma, and they will their team. It seems like the crowd is deliberately trying to will their team back from a 10-point hole, or they might do that in Toronto. I'm like, all right, our guys are down. We need to bring a spark that the players don't have. And in Philly, it often goes the other way. Players get tight, the crowd gets quiet. And then you get a library atmosphere that I think can compound the impact. So I think you want the players who can handle it. And then you want the audience on the particular night to say, I'm going to cheer here no matter what.
Yeah. Ideally, I do agree that the fan bases of sports teams in the city, it can be a little counterproductive at times, especially in big moments where it's already a tense or anxious environment. And then you're only kind of tacking on to that anxiety by your reaction to what's going on. Mm-hmm. If it's February, regular season game, and team's just coming out flat and looks like garbage, yeah, go ahead and boo. It's not, I think that's perfectly within reason, but yeah, there were definitely times that it seemed counterproductive.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like game 4, 2019 at the crib, you're hosting Toronto, Kawhi Leonard is in fierce robot mode. Tobias Harris is like 4 for 11 and the crowd is quiet. And it's like, oh, okay, this isn't going to help. You need the crowd to be so deliriously loud that the officials can't get calls right, because that tends to work in the home team's favor.
Yep. Yeah. You want that home court advantage to get that home cooking calls. You want to be lifted. Yeah. That was the Seahawks Packers game mm-hmm. you're referring to. Yeah, that was.
It was too loud to ref. they just give it to the home team.
Yeah, there was that now infamous picture where the refs one guy lifted his arms and one guy's called incomplete at the same time, and the photographer got this the great shot of that. Yeah, they were just so flustered, didn't know what to do. Yeah, you definitely want your fan base lifting those guys up, but you come here and. As an executive, if you're in Daryl's shoes, you just got to realize that's how it is. You would like to see some tweaks to the culture of the fans, but it's not going to happen. You just got to accept it as it is.
I thought it was also interesting that he was like, and less so in New York. He's almost jealous. People are always talking about how it's such a tough market, but maybe he's looking at like what happens when DeAndre Bembry goes on a cold streak in Brooklyn and no one cares at all.
Yeah, I think Brooklyn, because of the recency of, you know, the franchise becoming Brooklyn from being in the New Jersey Nets, I think that just doesn't have the same kind of like built-in history and anxious ridden fan base as like the Knicks or like if you're talking about the Yankees or whatever. I think Brooklyn, even though it is in New York, I just don't think it has that same kind of the angst and the ride or die fan base that can only come with like following a team for decades and growing up in your dad or your parents were huge fan bases of the team. And like, you can't have that yet in Brooklyn. It's just not possible. So,
right. You have that in New York. You know, I live in New York and I see it here. There are the ride or die fans, of course, but if you go to a Knicks game, there's a lot of people there to see the opposing team. There's a lot of people there that seem like they're just tourists. Like, hey, let's see a Knicks game.
Yeah.
And they just cheer really loud the whole game. And it doesn't feel like when you're sitting in the nosebleeds at Wells, it's different.
Yep, it is. And the last thing I want to say is regarding like the right mentality is just you gotta be good at pandering. Like fans really eat that stuff up when you like you're a Sixers guy and you throw out the first pitch at the Phillies game, or like you're spotted at an Eagles game and all you have to say is like, these are the best fans in the world. They want me to play my best and they demand it, and I'm going to give it everything I have because they work hard to afford the tickets and they deserve it. And that's
and
really all you have to say.
And if I
lap
don't,
it up.
They'll let me know, but I need that push too. And that helps me.
Yeah.
That's the full line.
It's really easy. Like Bryce Harper has been perfect at this ever since he arrived. Sirianni, head coach of the Eagles, has been great at it. Like it's not hard. There's a lane and you stick to it, and it more often than not will lead you on a path to a great relationship with the fan base. So yeah, that was Daryl's comments on it. I thought that was just an interesting thing to touch on. Before we shift away from Ben Simmons, though, we mentioned him there. Spike Eskin also brought this up on Twitter that DraftKings has a prop number of minutes that Ben will play in the Brooklyn opener against New Orleans, which is on October 19th. So just a little over a month away now, and it's over under 31 minutes. So I thought that'd be interesting to kind of just get your take on. What do you think? Do you think over under 31 minutes for Ben in the opener is a smart bet?
Oh, I think that's a tough one. I would take the under. I think, well, there's a chance that the games will blow out and then the under is easy one way or the other. Then there's the chance that they want to be relatively conservative. They were not that way with a guy like James Harden, but they were very much that way with a guy like Kevin Durant, who missed a full season healing from his Achilles surgery, and he only played in half the games the following. So if he even had a tight hamstring, he'd miss like a handful of games. I think the wise thing to do after Ben did a mental health slash holdout in Philadelphia, but then he flared up a herniated disc, I think at his L4, that required surgery. So I wouldn't be throwing him right back into the fire, even if he said he was ready. I'd be a little cautious there.
Yeah, I agree. I find that line really curious. It seems like an easy under for me. Even in his last season, he played in 2021. He only averaged 32 minutes a game in the regular season. So it's not like it's not like this line of 31 is abnormally low. And then for all the reasons you mentioned, yeah, he's coming off back surgery. So why would you push him? Like, you want to be conservative and kind of ramp him up over time, like see how he reacts.
So you need to play Nick Claxton. They're not going to mesh perfectly.
Yeah, so you got a lot of different rotational things to kind of figure out and kind of experiment with. And yeah, like you said, if it's a blowout, either way, you're going to kind of rest your guys in the fourth quarter. You're not going to get a high minutes total in that regard. So yeah, just seemed like an easy under. So I just wanted to make sure that there wasn't like a counter argument you can make, but I
never
I didn't
a good
see one.
Payout on those, though. It's like you bet $20 to win 14 or 15. It's like, why bother with those?
It was only minus 115 on either side. There wasn't really juice heavily towards the under at all. So yeah, just thought that was interesting.
I'd rather bet on the Eagles to win the Super Bowl.
Yeah. I always hate any kind of like season-long bets because I don't like my money to just be sitting there for months and not be able to access it.
True.
But yeah, I wouldn't make the bet now because I don't want to have to wait till October 20th to cash it out, even though I do think the under is a pretty easy play.
But I need those season-long bets to offset my daily in bets.
You make the smart, like calculated moves in your long, and then in the moment you're like, oh, it's Thursday night, I should make a play on this Thursday night football game I really don't know, have too much of a feeling on, but I'm gonna be watching it, so I should bet something.
Yeah, when Anthony Davis got hurt on Valentine's Day, I bet on the Suns to win the West, and that worked out, and that offset all my bets on the Sixers on a nightly basis.
There you go. Yeah, the in the moment passion bets don't tend to work out as well. All right, we're going to take a quick break and hear from our advertisers. And then when we get back, we're going to have some more directly Sixers related discussion leading up to the season.
Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. As a parent, you want your child to have every opportunity, but giving them the tools they need to tackle every challenge, that takes a team.
Now more than ever, educational support tailored exactly to what your child needs can make all the difference. That's why parents have trusted Sylvan Learning for 45 years as the ultimate teammate in their child's educational journey, instilling in them a love for learning and a passion for reaching the next level. And Sylvan's Insight Assessment can identify gaps in learning and areas that could be of concern for your child. It's a 360-degree view into your child's learning that you can't find anywhere else, and helps ensure that your child didn't miss something in school that might put them at a disadvantage in the future. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
All right, and we're back. So, Dave, look, the rotation, I feel like, is pretty much set now that Trez Harrell is a Sixer. The signing was made official earlier this week. So it seems like you got your starting five: Harden, Maxey, PJ Tucker, Tobias, Embiid. You got Trez backing up Embiid. You got Melton, House, probably Thibault, and Niang. And then one more kind of like Korkmaz, Shake Milton from that group. That's probably the 10 they're rolling into the season with. So wanted to ask you, do you see any challenges potentially that rotation could face? Any like fit concerns between certain rotations or bench groupings or whatever else? What are your thoughts when you see how the rotation looks to be breaking down?
Yeah, I think they need a trade. I think they I don't love the idea, and I agree with you. I think the closing lineup, more importantly than the starting lineup, because you know, maybe they decide to play Melton as a starter, but I do think the closing lineup with Doc Rivers especially is going to include PJ Tucker, right? Like, you're penciling in Joel and James. I think you can pencil in Maxey. I think you could pencil in Tobias. So then the last question is it Tucker? And Tucker is a veteran who probably is going to earn that role regardless of how he performs. I mean, I shouldn't have said earn. Like, Doc's going to play him to close games. And I think you lack floor spacing with those lineups. Like, it's going to be easy, like we last saw, to shade and make life extremely difficult for James Harden and Joel Embiid, because you're not terrified of Maxey, Harris, and Tucker as a trio of as three-point bombers. Maxey will let it fly. Tucker will let a couple per game fly. He'll certainly let them fly from the corners, but not at high volume. Tobias definitely wants to bounce it first. And so that's trouble right there from a floor spacing standpoint. And then on the other end, perimeter defense is lacking then, because Tobias, as well as he played against Siakam, is not someone you're really comfortable putting on a guy like Bradley Beal, right? If you were playing a team with perimeter scorers, a team like the Bulls, it's got multiple threats on the wing. And Tucker is also more of a stretch four naturally than he is a three. So there's another issue there from, and obviously Harden has his limitations. So the floor spacing and the perimeter defense, I think, will be issues with their projected starting closing lineup.
Yeah, Tom West and I kind of dove into closing lineups on a pod a while back, 6 weeks ago or so. It all signs point to it being Tucker. Like, that's going to be the starting group. And for all the reasons you kind of mentioned, like, Doc is always going to lean towards the vets. Tucker, you would think, would be your wing stopper. So if you're in the guts of a game and you have to go up against a big wing like a Tatum or a Siakam, like, Tucker's probably who they're going to go with as their first option to slow that guy down. And also, Tucker's a good fit offensively in the sense that he's a very low usage guy. Like, he's just going to spot up in the corner, which you want a guy that's going to be willing to do that when you have Embiid and Harden and Maxey all on the court. And, you know, Tobias too, who, according to his familial agent, wants to have the ball in his hands more and run more pick and rolls. But that's just not going to happen. So he had to become more comfortable and accustomed to being like a spot up, just rise and fire guy last year, especially after the Harden trade. So Tucker slots in really well. It's like a guy who's just going to be happy to not ever handle the ball. And once every 5 or 6 possessions, he'll get a pass in the corner and be expected to hit that shot. So in that sense, he's a good fit, but I agree with you that having him and Tobias as your forwards next to Embiid, who's already going to be, you know, in the painted area a decent amount, that could be a little clunky because, you know, we've talked about this for years. You're effectively either calling Tobias the three or Tucker the three, and both of them would be are better suited to the four. And it just seems like the Sixers have always been stuck in a situation where their optimal lineup includes Tobias as more of a three than as a four, based on the roster construction they have. So ideally you would prefer that like Tucker be your glue guy, bench guy, and you would have more of a natural swingman wing type and in your starting group, and then Tobias would be your four. But yeah, that's just not how the roster shakes out right now. So yeah, I agree. That could be a little clunky.
I'm almost worried that there could be like an Al Horford light feeling with Tucker, where you saw what he was in Boston and you really liked his ability to space the floor, but you need more of it here. And so if, you know, this Sixers team is screaming for a guy who can hit like 4 corner threes per game if wide open. And is Tucker that guy? He might be, but do they need him to do that more than Miami did? If so, are fans going to be disappointed? Jackson Frank did a good profile on, you know, him. He's a low volume shooter. He did have the floater working for him this year, although that might be some fool's gold there because players don't tend to shoot really well on floaters. You might regress to the mean a little bit. And his best ability to switch, you know, his best ability on defense is a switching defense, which they might not do a ton of, playing drop coverage with a guy like Joel. So there might be some fit concerns with Tucker in Philadelphia that there weren't in Miami. Not to say that it's going to be like a Horford level of what were you thinking, because he's a no-brainer signing for the Sixers. But if you're projecting him as the starter and the closer, you know, maybe a little clunkier than fans are thinking right now, right off the bat. So there's could be some growing pains.
Yeah, I'd expect some, an adjustment period for sure. I think fortunately Tucker is a very good corner shooter. Like he's shot 38% from corner threes for his career. He shot 41% last year. And that's pretty much all he takes. Like the last 4 years, his percentage of 3-point attempts that came from the corner were all around 85 to 90%. So that's like pretty exclusively where he shoots from. And he's above average at it. So, you know, he just sticks to his role. And yeah, I agree. There's going to be some growing pains because there always are when, you know, new players are trying to work out and develop chemistry together. But yeah, I think just more so finding a way for these guys to all kind of coexist with one ball and have people be willing to be spot up shooters more than they might ideally want to be is probably going to be the biggest challenge with the group.
Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise I don't like defensively. I feel like it'll be okay. You'd ideally like to have more of a on ball perimeter stopper. Like Maxey's a little too undersized for that and still kind of learning in, you know, he's still only a few years in the league, still trying to learn NBA defense and how to navigate that. And then Tucker is, you know, first of all, up there in age and never really the fleet of foot guy. He's more of like the banging forward type who can stop wings, but not really guard. So I feel like that's still kind of the hole this team has had. Maybe Melton can step into that and be helpful in that area, House in certain matchups, but yeah, they still kind of lack that guy, like the Patrick Beverley type that people have always, you know, been standing for the Sixers to go after. But yeah, I think that's probably the biggest concern in my mind as far as the rotation.
Yeah, sadly, there's a Mikal Bridges hole here, which he'd be like the perfect player they could add right now.
Yeah, Well, maybe if things continue falling apart in Phoenix with all that turmoil, then
yes,
one can hope. But now he just got signed to a big new deal, so I don't expect him to be going anywhere anytime soon, unless it's like part of a KD trade or something.
Maybe he'll force his way to Philadelphia to make it right now.
Is anyone left from the regime that traded him after 20 minutes? Because I feel like there would be some hard feelings there.
Yes, there are. There's Elton. There's Ned Cullen.
Yeah.
There's ownership.
Yeah. So I don't foresee him forcing his way here. I know you're kind of saying that jokingly, but yeah, there has to be some hard feelings, I would imagine.
Yeah.
All right. So next thing I wanted to ask you about was it was brought up with Adam Silver's press conference earlier this week, which was mostly about the Robert Sarver situation, but it also came up that the Sixers were, the investigation around the tampering charges against Philadelphia were still being, or still underway. And he mentioned that it wasn't a complaint from a specific team that opened the investigation in the first place. It was just kind of the league seeing what was going on and deciding. So I get, my first question is, do you believe Adam Silver when he says that another team didn't like call for this investigation? And then what's your prediction on how this is going to play out?
Yeah. If it's really tampering, did he specifically use that word? Because I'm not worried about that. They could look into that all they like. They need to look into every team with that stuff and slap some wrists. The problem would be if they wanted to look into what would be like salary cap circumnavigation, because that's the one that got the Minnesota Timberwolves docked like 5 first round picks, which, you know, if someone was like, how did James Harden take this pay cut and what did it allow them to do? And what's he going to get next year? And is that why PJ and House and Harrell are all here? So that would be the one that would be a lot worse. If they just say that the Sixers had some contact early with PJ Tucker, who cares?
I'll read you the exact wording, and this isn't Adam Silver's quote, but it's from Ira Winderman, who's the Heat beat person that kind of tweeted this out. He said, Adam Silver said the investigation into the 76ers timing of their signing of PJ Tucker is ongoing and was not opened because of a complaint from a team. So it seems like it's specifically the Tucker signing, which is more in line with previous investigations of like having conversations with a free agent and having a deal done before the quote unquote open window for free agency has started, even though like literally everyone gets signed seconds after the window's open. So it's like
6:01.
It's like an open secret deals. That, yeah. So,
and Keith Pompey was on this like 3 weeks early, and then Mark Stein. And...
Yeah. So it does seem like it's specifically about Tucker and not Harden and those other kind of salary cap things that you mentioned. So,
and Ira being on the Miami beat, so definitely seems like some sour grapes from a team who might have whined, and then, you know, Sixers fans will point out like, you guys just lost, didn't they just lose a pick for tampering with like Kyle Lowry or someone? So
yeah, they lost the second round pick. So I guess that's my other part of the question to you. Do you feel like that's just going to be what happens? Sixers lose a second round pick and everybody moves on?
If that happens, I think that's fine. Like, take their 53rd pick away in a year and a half or two and stop looking into James Harden's pay cut, because James Harden going back to Houston has left like as much money as his career earnings on the table. So to look into this $12 million too hard seems silly to me.
Yeah, it is silly because as we said, literally every team does this. It's, I guess, you just have to be better about being circumspect and concealing it from media sources and everything else, just so it doesn't get out there. They just don't want it to be trumpeted to the world, the league. Mm-hmm. They just want it to be very much on the down low. So it's kind
Maybe
of like
Tucker's agent needs a reprimand. Like, why did you tell Keith?
Yeah, just like let
he
him break
to
the story.
At those greater Philadelphia area business interests 3 weeks early.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but yeah, as you said, if it's just a pick in the 50s, you're not going to lose too much sleep over it. Probably a worthwhile price to pay for getting the signing done in the first place. But yeah,
not Nikola Jokic. What was he like? Pick 45 or something?
Yeah. So you could miss out on the next Jokic or Ginobili, but it's very, very rare that those things actually transpire that way. So yeah, wouldn't be the end of the world. Real quick, last thing we wanted to touch on, and it's going to be kind of a rapid fire segment. Is there any main improvement you would like to see a Sixer make heading into the next season? Like, what's if you're Drew Hanlon and you're in charge of everybody's player development this summer, what would be the one of the main things you would have liked to see happen?
I would, if I'm Drew, I'm working with Joel on continuing to improve his passing and his willingness to pass. And, you know, he's going to have to, if he wants the ball on the block, he's going to have to do a lot of fighting. And Miami showed that was not a worthy pursuit because he was falling every third play in the final game. We saw him. He didn't look right physically. You know, he took Danny Green's knees out. He almost took Tobias Harris. I don't know if it was the mask, the finger, the face, the concussion symptoms or what, but he was getting beat up. He was diving into the stands. That was too hard. So we have already seen some language that he's looking to improve from the perimeter, maybe his handle, so that I suppose in theory he could catch the ball behind the arc, which would maybe space the floor for James Harden, who likes to attack a spread floor, but also allow Joel to have some more room to operate. I don't know what the thinking is. Is he going to drive from 25 feet away and kick? Is he going to try to finish at the rim from there? But I would like him to work on his passing because there were times where they could get him a touch and jumping to receive the ball, he could have kicked it back out to an open shooter. Now, his shooters let him down, certainly. James Harden was not a willing catch and shoot player. Tobias Harris is a little slow on the trigger. Tyrese Maxey's developing there, but he's still not a player who teams absolutely fear in terms of gravity. So Joel just trusting them and continuing to make the right read, even in a huge moment, you know, like even in a game five at home where you're down by 6 or 7, you haven't had a ton of points and it feels like you should be exerting your will. I'd still like to see him make the right pass if an open shooter is wide open rather than settle for those tough mid-range shots.
Yeah. And I think Drew mentioned previously that the primary focus for Joel this offseason was, you know, working off his off the dribble game and kind of creating stuff off the dribble. So for the reasons you mentioned, it's a lot easier on his body to not have to take the pounding in the painted area down low and be able to initiate the offense from closer to the arc. And we saw, not really last year, but in a lot of years past, that Sixers would try to get him the ball in crunch time and they just didn't have good entry passers. So it like the shot clock would wind down and maybe they'd finally get him to like 8 seconds left and he'd have very little time to get a move going and he'd have to hoist some like off balance shot or something.
And even with Harden last year, we saw Harden have trouble getting him the lobs when they were fronting. Well, yeah. But I'll throw it back to you. What would you like to see?
Real quick, cause we're almost out of time, but yeah, my main thing would be Tyrese Maxey becoming more of like a drive and kick threat. He's going to be running the second unit when Harden's out. And I know one of the things has always been to kind of mold him into more of a point guard because he's traditionally more of a combo guard, and they still need that him to be effective in that role alongside Harden. But my mind goes back to John Wall in his prime when he was just able to harness that elite speed and get into the paint, draw defenders, and then kick guys in the corners. He was one of the best at finding those guys in the corners. And Maxey has a good mentor in Harden to kind of work that area of his game. Like he kind of adopted the Harden step back pretty quickly working together with him. So yeah, I'd like to see him also get that drive and kick game to the corners down much more this season.
Wall is also a terrific defender in his day.
Yeah, he was. Excited to see the John Wall come back here this year. I want to see if he has anything left in the tank. All right, Dave. Well, this was a lot of fun. Appreciate you once again joining me this week to discuss all things Sixers and Sixers adjacent. Where can everybody find you online and your work?
At Liberty Ballers. We'll work there.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave, and everyone else out there. We'll talk to you next week. Have a good one.